I'm Ben Weingarten.
I'm Ines Stepman.
I'm Amber Duke.
And I'm Will Chamberlain.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, as always, we have a riveting and I think dynamic set of topics to cover today. Will is going to start us off by talking about the foreign aid package that has now cleared the Senate. I will talk a bit about the occupation of my alma mater, Columbia, by pro-Hamas fanatics and the schools cowering in the face of their occupation. Inez is going to talk about the Biden administration's redefinition of Title IX. And last but not least, Amber will take us home by talking about the Biden EEOC's efforts to pursue convenience stores over purported discrimination. So with that, let's toss it over to Will first.
Yeah, so in the beginning, let's talk capitulation. The House and Senate Republicans have both agreed to pass exactly what the Biden administration has been asking for almost a year in exchange for absolutely nothing. They agreed to pass a $90 billion aid package that includes over $60 billion of aid to Ukraine, $15 billion to Israel, a few billion to Hamas in the form of humanitarian aid, just because we want to be funding both sides of the Israeli-Hamas war, obviously. And I don't even know if there was any border security in this. Actually, I have to look closely, but if anything, it was trivial. This is a massive capitulation. There was a long debate. And the Senate even, you know, bravely, you know, the House was supposed to reject any foreign aid bill if there was not going to be border security attached. Mike Johnson repeatedly said that that was the position of the House, that we're not doing anything on Ukraine, anything on foreign aid. We'll do Israel, but we won't do Ukraine unless you give us foreign aid. And that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because as much as the Democrats may care about Ukraine and as much as Mitch McConnell may care about Ukraine, that is fundamentally a partisan priority of the Democrat Party. It's not necessarily an interest of the Republican Party. And if that's not to say we shouldn't under any circumstances give money to Ukraine, but rather that if you are a Republican looking out for serving the interests of Republican voters, you would say, you want this, you want $60 billion from our taxpayers, you're going to give us something in return and something meaningful, not bogus. We passed HR 2. That's the beginning of negotiations. You need to give us real commitments and real restraints on the executive and border security so that our country stops being invaded. And for reasons that are becoming clearer as more and more news reports leaked out, Mike Johnson went from this hardline negotiating position to a complete 180, just giving up. You know, we talk about bipartisan in Washington. It's always easy to be bipartisan when you just decide to stop representing your voters' interests and give the opposing party what they want. The opposing party is always happy to take 100% victory while giving up nothing in return. And that's essentially what happened here. It's clear Mitch McConnell and has been working Mike Johnson. I mean, the way I look at this, honestly, is that McConnell and Schumer, they've been in leadership for 30 years, and this is Mike Johnson's first go-round. They saw a fish at the table when they knew a fish at the table when they saw one. It's like that scene in Rounders where everybody watches, you know, the random tourists showing up at the poker table and realizes they're going to take all their money. Mike Johnson was an amateur. He capitulated. They gave him all these policy reasons to sell out his voters, and that's exactly what he did. He has no business being speaker. This is a peacetime conservative, not a person who's prepared at all for the modern political environment. And honestly, I mean, one of the big takes I had is we were a lot better off with Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy wouldn't have gotten rolled like this. People might disagree, but you know, there's things Kevin McCarthy had to do. Like you can't let the debt ceiling go. You have to raise the debt ceiling because you can't let the economy collapse. But when it came to Ukraine, Kevin McCarthy wouldn't have gotten nothing for Ukraine. Kevin McCarthy's been around the block. He would have gotten something for it. And it also just is like, why did we even bother? What was the point of replacing Kevin McCarthy? You know, he couldn't have done worse than this. This is about as poor an outcome as I can imagine. And it's just depressing. Well, all it means is, you know, I can't blame Republican voters for being demoralized and not showing up. I think they should. But I have to say that I'm, you know, it's just an embarrassing spectacle from a Republican Congress that, you know, and a particularly embarrassing one from a Republican Congress that hasn't exactly sparkled throughout the last few years. With that, I'll pass it to the group.
I found it particularly infuriating that the Ukraine aid specifically was sold to the base as a loan when the bill specifically provides two separate occasions on which the executive can forgive the loan. And you even have establishment Republicans like Mitt Romney coming out and saying that literally no one in Congress expects Ukraine to pay the money back. So Mike Johnson not only capitulated to the Democrats, but really actively lied to conservatives in the caucus and to the Republican base of voters by trying to sell this as something that it wasn't. It's precisely the same runaround that we got on the Senate border bill, which is more of an immigration reform bill than a border bill, where they talked about the shutting down of the border that occurs after you get more than 5,000 migrants a day coming across. And then you quickly find out that actually the president has the authority to overturn the emergency authorization. And there's all of these other elements related to it that basically render it useless. It's the same exact thing with this loan to Ukraine. So, I mean, that aspect of it, from Mike Johnson to actively lie about what was actually going to be the nature of the Ukraine aid, makes it so much worse.
Yeah, I mean, I probably don't object nearly as much to the substance of this as you three do. I have no problem sending Ukraine aid. I think it is in American interest to do so. That being said, I think Will is completely right about the fact that we got nothing in exchange, right? The Democrats desperately wanted to pass that piece of the package. And we had that whole fight, you know, over the fake immigration bill that Amber was referencing, the one that was an embarrassment in terms of negotiation. And if that negotiation had been conducted competently, then the Republican caucus would have had something to show for it. Now it seems like that Will is right. They got nothing in exchange. This is not how one plays politics or poker. And I do agree. So I'm not ready to throw Speaker Johnson to the wolves yet. I think he is learning. I don't know. It's a very difficult position. We haven't had a good speaker in many, many years. And we've had a parade of terrible Republican speakers, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't really see anyone better in the wings waiting to step up to replace Johnson. So I'm sort of willing to give him some time to get his legs under. Maybe he will remember this as the moment he got Rickrolled and do better in the future. I don't know. I can't predict that. But I mean, I think McCarthy got similarly Rickrolled on a bunch of the negotiations. And yeah, unfortunately, we do not have. And I don't know. I'm curious, actually, if any of you have somebody in mind when you think about somebody who could step up and be a statesman, be like an actual leadership voice in the Republican Party, aside from the presidential race. Because it seems like what we increasingly have, even on the Senate side, are a bunch of people, I mean, with the exception of Mitch McConnell, who was very good in the wrong direction for the Republican Party, in the sense that he was good at his job, but wasn't advocating on behalf of the interests of his party. If there is anyone you guys have in mind that actually could be a legislative statesman and leader for the Republican Party who would take the concerns of the base seriously, because I mean, I'm starting to like give up hope that there is any such person in the House or maybe even in the Senate.
I will table my name or several names that might fit the bill. Obviously, this is a hugely consequential question of, is there someone who is ideologically aligned with the nationalist populist orientation of really the animated part of the conservative base and likely the future of the conservative base in particular. If you look at younger Senate Republicans, for example, and many in the Freedom Caucus as well, but who can combine the ideological orientation with the tactics and the strategy necessary to move forward a fractious conference in a way that's consistent with our values, principles, and our goals. Obviously, that's the whole ballgame and a very difficult question. So I'll set that aside and maybe we can talk about it in parting shots. But I would just say, you think about this. When have you ever had a Democrat speaker who needs massive percentages of Republicans to pass their agenda and then does so over the objections of much of their conference? It's totally inconceivable. So I don't even think that controlled opposition even does justice to what we're talking about here. And I'd go even deeper than the question of, well, I would ask the question, you know, what is the point of Republicans essentially and Republican leadership if this is what you get, if it's Democrat light? And then crammed down our throats as an agenda that we disagree with that has been sanctioned by Republicans. You know, from the perspective of the politics versus the policy aspect of it, beyond, of course, you had this leverage and you paved on it, as Republicans always do. There's another question of like, who would the speaker and leadership say they were trying to appeal to here? And the only thing that I can fathom, since it's obviously not conservatives who, to Will's point, are demoralized, and who knows, is this going to lead the base to potentially some percentage of it, some meaningful percentage of it, maybe in meaningful jurisdictions, to sit on their hands in the 2024 election? I don't know. I assume that in their own minds, their justification is, well, you know, this takes issues off the table for the suburban purple state voters that they feel they're going to need to grow or minimally maintain a very small House majority. Maybe that would be the rationale, but I think it's a failing rationale, because I think ultimately, still at the end of the day, set aside, you know, the uniparty kind of fervor among those purple suburban voters, at the end of the day, you still have open borders, and you still have, you have the FBI director going out and talking about how there are all these threats to the homeland percolating, and we're focused on everything going on around the world. You can't trust the leadership who's making the decisions about what we're doing around the world, and that they're actually not working with our enemies in conjunction with some of those engagements. And yet we're going to throw more money at the very uniparty establishment that has deteriorated America's national interest for the last 20 plus years in engagements, that doesn't win conflicts. It manages conflicts and funds all sides in the conflicts incoherently, again, while the border is still open and you have God knows how many terrorist cells probably exist in this country as a consequence, how many Chinese Communist Party agents are operating with impunity right now in this country, Russian adversarial forces, I'm sure, here as well. So you go down the list, it's a disaster all the way around. And I don't know who this wins with ultimately. And that's one of the most baffling aspects of it. What's the political consideration behind this? How could this possibly be in their political self-interest? So something worth pondering as we go forward. And again, maybe something we can take up at parting shots. On that note, I will transition to myself here to talk about a seemingly unrelated issue, although I do think there's a nexus between the two as well. And that is the conceding or the ceding of Columbia University, its quad, and really the operations of the entire school to pro-Hamas protesters that has been on display now running for several days. Columbia itself has been a hotbed of Jew hatred since October 7th. And really, of course, dating back multiple decades, Barry Weiss's rise in some ways to the national figure that she is started in part during her time at Columbia, really 2 decades ago, looking at Columbia's Middle Eastern Studies Department, which has been a hotbed of Islamist, so-called anti-Zionist, and also anti-American fervor going back decades. This is the school of Edward Said. And this is a school where, when I attended, going back over a decade, invited Mahmoud Ahmadinejad notoriously to come speak, has had Israeli apartheid weeks every year, annually, for many years. So what we're seeing now is something, and this is, of course, illustrative of what happens at all elite, so-called elite schools throughout this country and beyond, which is they have been in hock to the pro-Islamist radicals who make common cause with the progressive groups on campuses, and they've been colluding and consorting for years and engaging in this kind of activism. But now it's exploded, and you have a president of Columbia who goes up before Congress and tries to sweet-talk her way out of the fact that the school was being investigated even by this administration for the Jew hatred that exploded on campus after October 7th. And basically, after this, after going up on the Hill and being berated by some, and rightly so, comes back to campus to these encampments being set up by protesters who are menacing, they're threatening, they're basically, if not inciting violence, at the very least, and some engaging seemingly in violent acts, are menacing and threatening people on campus, particularly Jews and others, lighting flags on fire, siding with Hamas and other jihadist groups in their rhetoric. And these are basically anti-civilizational and at core anti-Western forces that we're talking about. Now, the president herself allowed the NYPD to come in and clear out some of these encampments several days ago, several students were suspended, including Ilhan Omar's daughter, who is a Marxist straight up. However, after the NYPD came in and cleared out, to some extent, the encampments are back with a vengeance, and they're growing, and they're actually spreading to other college campuses as well. And you have this cowed, submissive leadership at Columbia who's negotiating essentially with the inmates who she's allowed to run the asylum there. And this problem, this crisis of and chaos on the campus continues. I think to try to distill it and summarize it, all you need to know about Columbia in 2024, and it's representative of a myriad institutions, is that Jewish students didn't feel safe to walk campus on Passover Eve as a consequence of the policies of administrators who have devoted themselves to creating safe spaces on campuses for everyone under the sun that constitutes protected cohorts who are ideologically aligned with them. But now you have a place where Jews can't comfortably, safely walk on the campus. And it's justified when you look at the Jew hatred that's been fomented at Columbia and elsewhere. So now you have we're at a point where Columbia has gone to remote optional for the rest of the semester. You can't think of a much more damning outcome, dereliction of duty by purported leadership. But I think the point to emphasize is that this was predictable and predicted. The schools, all of the elite schools, are in hock to the progressives who run them, the progressive students, the progressive faculty who have stood in large part in solidarity with the students at Columbia who are controlling the campus. Of course, they have the anti-disciplinarian aspect as well that exists as a consequence of their progressive worldview. But it's also the fact that you have foreign students, including from Middle Eastern countries, who hold these same pathologies as the ones you're seeing explode at Columbia and elsewhere, who pay full freight. And then you have foreign adversarial regimes with the same worldviews who also contribute tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to schools like Columbia. So you put it all together, and this is as predictable as one could possibly expect. And maybe the most disturbing thing is not that, wow, this is suddenly exploding into public view in a way that we haven't seen before, but it's that the consequences are, first of all, that the Jews are the canary in the coal mine here. And ultimately, these are anti-American activists. They're the same ones who are anti-Christian, anti-conservative, anti-white. It's all part and parcel and a product of and related to, correlated with the DEI, CRT sort of ideology on the campuses. But of course, that these are the people who are going to matriculate up into the corridors of power and in fact are already there. And that to me is maybe the most disturbing thing and the short-sighted thing about, for example, Republicans who are now focusing on this issue. These are not isolated issues on college campuses. They're issues on college campuses that are endemic to those campuses. They don't go away if all the leaders at these schools were to step down tomorrow. They probably don't even go away if you have every student who promotes jihad on campuses expelled, if you deport the non-citizen faculty and students who are promoting jihad and the groups associated with them, if you kick them off campus, even if you prohibit the foreign funding necessarily to the campuses. I'm not sure this all stops because it's so deeply rooted. It's so basic to the fabric of these places. But beyond that, it's that you already see the consequences in really the last almost 12 years of Obama-Biden rule. And that to me is the most disturbing and scary thing about all of this, is that the graduate, we already have just the buttoned up graduated versions of these ideologues who dominate large swaths of the administrative state, certainly of the progressive caucus of the Democrat Party in Congress as well. And so we're already dealing with the consequences of it nationally on a policy basis. So if you want to deal with this problem, you can't play whack-a-mole or look at these campuses in isolation. It is actually a far more systemic and pervasive problem. And we have to deal with both the root causes as well as the consequences of it at the same time. So that's my perspective on the situation. And obviously, would love to open it up and see kind of what your take is on all the goings on at Columbia and the broader implications.
So first of all, I agree with very much with your characterization. This is endemic to the campus environment. It's completely predictable. It's intertwined with the ideological worldview that is prominent on American universities. And it will neither, you know, neither begun with Jew hatred, nor will it end with Jew hatred. It's intertwined. These same people are at the same time, you know, chanting anti-American slogans. They say that America is a evil, racist, colonial power on stolen land. All of these things are part and parcel of a seamless worldview that has been in predominance in American universities really since the 60s and been gaining power really outside of the universities since then. So to that extent, I don't think this is the next Kristallnacht or something like that. I think it's the next crop of Shehzadbuddins. These are the next, you know, crop of people who will graduate into a whole bunch of positions of power in American society and will take that radical worldview with them into those positions. This is a dynamic we've already been, you know, highlighting on the right at least for 30 or 40 years. I mean, you can go back to William F. Buckley writing God and Man at Yale. That's 70 years ago. We haven't done anything about it. We have at no point treated the universities as the ideologically hostile entities that they are. We have not, as Will and I keep talking about, we haven't, you know, taxed their endowments. We haven't removed the enormous benefits that almost all of them are dependent on in terms of taxpayer money. You know, Columbia would have a huge hole in its budget blown tomorrow. It would have to fire massive amounts of its staff, even with the endowment that it has, if all of a sudden, you know, that there were no more federal dollars going to student loans or grants to Columbia University. We are completely politically able to control the psycho behavior of universities. We choose not to. There's no political will on the right to go ahead and implement those kinds of policies. I do want to make one final point, which is the distinction between sort of harassment under the civil rights law and the right to attend and exercise a right to attend a university in America, take advantage of educational opportunities without, you know, racial or sexual harassment. I do think there have been incidents that have risen to that level. The sheer number of universities now with complaints filed under the Civil Rights Act is something like 30 or 40 of them. So some of these things do cross that line, right? Like pointing to Jewish students and saying Al-Qassam's next target. That's a threat. That's a racial threat, right? So some of these things, I think, do cross the line. On the other hand, and here's maybe where I differ slightly with Ben, I do not think it's justified for Jewish students to be afraid to show up on campus. I don't think they should be retreating to their dorms. I think that they should be out there counter-protesting. This is still America. I mean, I know we doubt that every week on here. America is not an anti-Semitic country. There is an ideology among America's elite that includes, among many other hatreds, as we talked about, primarily among them America, hatred of Jews. But I don't think that that justifies withdrawing from either a campus or public life. Although I definitely think if you know, I were a parent thinking about sending my Jewish child to Columbia, I would be looking at Hillsdale instead. But I would be doing that for any number of reasons before this incident as well. I just don't like, you know, America is still a very, very tolerant country of Jews. It is not dangerous to be a Jew in America. It is uncomfortable and perhaps mildly dangerous in terms of, like, you know, getting punched in the face, which is unacceptable, don't get me wrong, in certain milieus and certain, environments, including elite schools like Columbia University. It is not dangerous to walk around as a open and proud Jew in Mobile, Alabama. And I think that's really important to keep underscoring, that most of this country is a remarkably tolerant place for Jews. And so some of it, I think some of the rhetoric around it, I don't agree with the defensive posture. I don't think people should go home. I think they should counter protest. I think they should be out there. They should be filming this. They should be putting it online. And some people are, like, some people are definitely doing that, but there is, I think, this tendency to, maybe to react to this in a way that I think is counterproductive and overly defensive. I think at the end of the day, there is this uncomfortable marriage between the same BLM activists, right? And then this very this imported foreign element, right, that are coming from countries where Jew hatred is much more is much more lizard brained and ancient and tribal, and in those cultures. And so there is this like combustible combination of American leftism with imported Arab Muslim sentiment about Jews and about Israel. I'm not downplaying any of this. I don't think the solution is, you know, to tell Jewish students to stay in their dorms or to attend university, you know, remotely. Although I definitely think that Jews and anybody who finds the behavior of the universities for the last 30 or 50 years objectionable should think very hard about whether or not your money as a donor, as a parent, as a student should be going to these institutions, and then whether all of our money as taxpayers and as Americans should be going to these institutions.
Yeah, actually, I tend to agree with Inez. I find myself sort of like reflexively like cringing almost at some of the testimony of Jewish students in Congress about how they feel unsafe on campus because of some of the things that have been said. And like, granted, there absolutely have been instances where anti-Semitic remarks have obviously crossed the line, where there have been threatening remarks made. But I also want to be cautious of not using the same language to describe speech that the left often uses in regards to conservative speakers, which is one of the problems that has plagued campuses for a while now. The idea that if someone says something objectionable or even disgusting, that you feel unsafe by it. It's part of the coddling of university students that I think the right has objected to. But I also just want to plug my book here. It's called The Snowflakes Revolt, because it is precisely about this problem that we're identifying of the fact that these ideologies do not stop at campus, right? This was a fundamental conceit of the right, that these people would grow up, they'd enter the real world, corporations or whomever was hiring them would not allow them to behave in this way, that they would naturally become conservative because they would start paying taxes or whatever the argument was. And none of that happened. Now we've seen the takeover of the entertainment industry, of the media, of politics, of a lot of these people going back into academia and further infecting the college campuses. This is clearly a university to American institution pipeline that is not going away anytime soon. These students are not moderating. My book is specifically about how they've taken over the media. All of these newsroom revolts that we see at places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Politico, USA Today are directly the result of them hiring these students from elite universities who hold these very noxious views and view the institutions as the next step of their takeover to use as platforms for their radical activism. So when we're looking at what's happening at Columbia, that's something that we absolutely need to understand. And then finally, I would just say that as we film this, I'm at Cornell University, where I was moderating a debate the evening prior to our recording about free speech on campus. And it was between Ilya Shapiro, who was sort of pushed out of Georgetown Law School because of a tweet he made about a Supreme Court justice, versus Dr. Marianne Franks, who is a very progressive, supposedly free speech expert. And it was interesting to hear their sort of varying viewpoints on speech on campus, where Marianne Franks was very concerned about the content of speech. So she was very protective of students like the ones at Columbia, despite the fact that they were violating campus policy, and seemed quite eager to shut down, for example, Ann Coulter, who recently spoke at Cornell University, because she didn't view her as a value add to whatever conversations students are having on campus. Whereas Ilya was very process oriented, which is everybody has the right to free speech, regardless of whatever content they're spouting, but they have to abide by the rules that a campus sets. And those two varying viewpoints made it very hard, I think, to reach a common ground on how exactly speech should be treated on campus. So just wanted to share that perspective, seeing it firsthand here at Cornell last night.
Yeah, I'm a little bit torn in this sense alone. Like, obviously, I feel very badly for the Jewish students on campus, and the behavior of all these protesters is appalling, and I'd like nothing more than to see them wailing as they're arrested and taken off to jail. But on the other hand, I am tempted by the idea of them gaining squatters' rights in over Columbia University and then being impossible to evict, thus making the university's life impossible. I mean, the university bears a ton of blame here. These are their students and their faculty. This is the values they have inculcated over many years. Columbia is notorious, especially their Arab Studies department, as being a hotbed of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment. So, you know, I think they're getting their just desserts. They're also unwilling to do basic things. The university has the full ability to stop this if they wanted to. They just need the will. You know, I saw that there were some faculty members who were protesting the removal of the encampment, let them know that their, you know, any future involvement in this protest, quote unquote, in this occupation will be seen as a letter of resignation, and they'll be handed their papers. It'd be very straightforward to handle all this, just involve it to a lot of firings and expulsions, but it would be fairly simple to do. The fact that they're not willing to do so indicates that maybe this university doesn't have the will to continue. Maybe it's, you know, should be turned it transformed into something completely different. I saw some tweet out there saying that, you know, Columbia originally was a mental asylum. Well, you know, we don't have enough mental hospitals in this country and we have far too many Ivy League universities. So I sense a natural possibility for transitioning things back to the way things ought to be. Anyway, I'll pass it back.
Well, I second that. And let me just say, to be abundantly clear here, I don't condone at all anyone cowering in the face of the pro-Hamas protesters in the middle of campus. My basic point is you have to impose your rules when people violate the codes of conduct, when they violate the policies, and when they run up against laws. And it's very clear that there are individuals who are running up against laws in terms of assaulting or harassing people, et cetera. And many other free speech proponents like myself agree that that's the case. Something needs to be done. And of course, the school is completely derelict in its duty. And of course, the hiding behind safetyism, all that point completely taken and agreed with there. But the fact that there are some who genuinely would feel uncomfortable, I do think it's reasonable to feel uncomfortable when you have people glorifying Hamas and calling for spreading the Intifada around the world. That would be menacing. It would be uncomfortable. And I don't use that in the way that the left talks about things being problematic or uncomfortable. So I just want to put that out there. But everyone should stand courageously against these bigots and crybullies. And with that, I'll turn it over to Inez.
Yeah, so there was a regulation dropped last Friday that will have more impact on American law than almost anything that I can recall Congress doing for the last, I don't know, 10 years probably. And that is the Title IX regulations that the Biden administration released in their final form, as I say, last Friday. And bear with me because there are, and I'm only covering, you know, a small part of the 1577 pages of these regulations, but there are really three main areas that are impacted. First and most sweeping, the Biden administration is redefining sex in Title IX to include gender identity and very explicitly saying that it does harm to transgender students, whether they're in kindergarten or in law school, allegedly to treat them as the biological sex that they actually are. Now, that has implications for bathrooms, locker rooms, all the usual things that we usually see this fight crop up around. There was an attempt to carve out sports here. I think that is because there have been that the issue of women's sports has been a politically successful one for Republicans and for moderates. Clearly, this is sort of a political carve out. The plain reading of the regulations absolutely applies to women's sports. And in fact, the administration is already filing in federal court, specifically in the Fourth Circuit, against the state of West Virginia, saying that that state's law that keeps women's sports to females only, radical concept, I know, is in conflict with the administration's perception of Title IX. So they're saying one thing, but they're doing another in federal court. So I don't think this is a distinction. It's a political fig leaf. It's the kind of political fig leaf that media is only too happy to run with. And I will note that none of the Sunday shows, as Emily Dushinsky has pointed out, none of the Sunday shows said a word last weekend. This huge regulation that redefines sex in federal law for every institution that takes a dime of federal money. That's all the universities we were just talking about, of course. But it's also K through 12 schools, all public schools, to some extent, some private schools, because they might be taking grants from the federal government. There are various kinds of programs that do sometimes have federal monies flowing into private schools. So potentially the reach of this is massive. So that's the biggest change that has rightly been, I think, to the extent that there has been coverage. And here I want to especially shout out Megyn Kelly, who has been just consistently always on top of covering this issue as the monumental issue that it is. But aside from independent media and conservative media, you know, there has been very little mainstream coverage of these regulations. But that's just the first thing that this regulation does. It also strips due process protections. We are going back to the kangaroo court era under Obama, which is not a surprise because as vice president, Joe Biden was very intimately involved in crafting those Dear Colleague letters and those policies under the Obama administration. I will point out here that, of course, Joe Biden did not submit himself to the Star Chamber when accused of sexual assault by Tara Reid. He conveniently just ignored that accusation and the media went along with it. But he has no interest in submitting himself to the rules that he wants to impose on mostly college men. But those rules are completely outrageous. They are a total mockery of a fair process. And federal courts have, at this point, hundreds of times awarded settlements to college men who have actually, you know, had the money, the resources, the time, the will to fight it out in federal court. We're talking about a procedure that goes back to a single investigator model being permitted, which is a Title IX, biased Title IX investigator who chooses what kind of evidence to look for. So one of the things that these Title IX investigators are trained in is so-called trauma-informed evidence examination, which is, for example, not allowing into the investigation text messages after the fact. So if a girl says that she was assaulted by a fellow student, and then for the next month she was texting him to come back over, that's not admittable evidence because that could be a trauma response. So that's, you know, we're moving back to the single investigator model, which is inherently unfair. It's not an impartial adjudicator, stripping the right to have a representative in those proceedings, memory of what you're being accused of when you walk in, which means some of these students will be walking into these proceedings with no specific details about what they're even being accused of before they walk into the hearing, right? So it's not on, you know, Friday the 11th, you did X, Y, and Z to this girl, right? It's just you have been accused of sexual misconduct. So that's another massive incursion into what our courts have defined as constitutional rights. And then third, there's a massive First Amendment and free speech component to this. They're returning to an unconstitutionally vague definition of what harassment is. So we were just talking about that line between harassment and free speech. Well, you know, maybe pointing to particular Jewish students and saying Al-Qassam hit here crosses that line. But for sure, general remarks do not. So what we're seeing is students filing Title IX complaints against a professor for saying something that they find subjectively offensive, for example, about men and women. And these regulations, bolster those kinds of complaints, make them legitimate. Again, this is contradictory to the courts. We're always hearing about, you know, the right defying the Supreme Court or whatever. But this is very directly defying the definition of harassment and of compelled speech when we're coming to pronouns, for example, for a student to start using quote unquote misgendering pronouns, right? These are things that the Supreme Court has laid out quite clearly, and these regulations contradict. So just to wrap up, that's really the tip of the iceberg. These are massive regulations. They go well beyond the power of the federal government. You know, this is all from a little statute that says that any institution, educational institution taking federal money cannot engage in discrimination on the basis of sex. So it's inverting the plain language of the statute and adding a bunch of stuff that comes from, you know, the heads of unelected bureaucrats, goes well beyond the powers of the executive and of executive agencies. We have a court now that looks more askance at that kind of regulatory power and that kind of agency power. So there are lawsuits. My own organization, Independent Women's Forum and Independent Women's Law Center, we're filing lawsuits. There are lots of other organizations that are doing the same. I hope these lawsuits will be successful. But this is a massive, massive incursion into American law. It has impacts this is blowing up women's and men's rights across the country. And I hope that it will be an issue in the election because I think it puts once again the lie that Joe Biden is any kind of like this kind of cultural moderate game that he likes to play in front of the camera. Sometimes his administration is staffed with the most radical leftist activists and they have free rein to do whatever they want.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate how infuriating this is, how radical this is. It essentially eliminates sex segregated spaces of any kind at any school level. This is obviously not, just to reiterate, a college level statute. This applies to elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, locker rooms, bathrooms, sports teams, shower facilities, housing, basically every potentially sex segregated area in a school can no longer be that, because it would be a violation of federal law for school administrators to deny access to those spaces to members of the opposite sex who claim that their gender identity matches the sex of the space that they want to enter. This is vulnerable young women who are in arguably the most sensitive time of their lives, exposes them to potential predators, to having to expose themselves to members of the opposite sex. It could lead to at boarding schools or colleges of young people having to share dorms with members of the opposite sex. This is no small matter, as Inez said, and there should be way more outrage about this. This went through the rulemaking period for the past few months, and there were some conservatives talking about it, but not enough. This really is a gigantic overhaul of everything that we believe to be true and necessary for women's protection on the federal education level. It's disastrous.
I remember this being an issue even like during the Obama administration, and it really being very offensive to male university students, completely denying everybody due process. The Trump administration got rid of it, but apparently the Biden team just don't like due process. They don't like basic procedural fairness. And it connects broadly to the liberal outlook on the world, which is the sense of moral absolute righteousness, and therefore the notion that procedural fairness is in fact immoral because it allows for bad things to happen from their perspective. It's very anti-American outlook. Is it really a surprise? This is what, they not only do they insist on funding the universities to the hilt for giving everybody student loans, but they make universities the most unfriendly place possible for just conservative people. So, it's appalling in a number of different ways. I didn't even get to the trans stuff, but shame on the Biden administration. And just another reason why friends don't let friends vote Democrat.
Yeah, I guess this is also illustrative of the broader point of, first of all, the left always uses whatever levers they can to first essentially incentivize broken families and the breakdown in families, then replace them with the schools that socialize and indoctrinate them, then turn those schools into or impose the kind of quote unquote justice system, but an unjust justice system. Of the kind that they would ultimately like to graft onto the actual justice system writ large in the country. And you see how they take a small statute and they warp it and turn it into a behemoth like this. And they use every lever of power again that they can, the administrative state, of course, being among the most coercive, and everything the administrative state touches turns to exactly the kind of thing you're seeing here. And the only thing one could say is, you would think that there would be a political price to pay for this, but I haven't seen certainly mass outrage over this, let alone Republicans saying much about this. But it's clearly, I think, in part an election year gambit, and at the very worst case, an attempt to put on the books regulations that a Republican president would have to eviscerate, but not without time and effort and probably some political price that the left will impose. So once again, it's not even like Democrats playing chess and Republicans playing checkers. We're in two different worlds, and one is playing a highly sophisticated, aggressive, assertive sort of style of a game, and Republicans are basically MIA.
All right, and I will go ahead and move into the final topic for today, which is the lawsuit that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has filed against Sheetz, which is a gas station / convenience store. If you're from the Mid-Atlantic region of the U.S., as they call it, then you are very familiar with Sheetz. This is where when I was in high school, we would go meet up and wait for our friends to show up. And this is how we would find out where the parties were. And maybe we would get some mozzarella sticks while we were there. Great American institution. It's like, it's very similar to Wawa, but there's like a huge Sheetz Wawa debate. I'm obviously team Sheetz, but this lawsuit is pure insanity. I know Jeremy Carl has a book coming out, if it's not out already, about sort of the criminalization of white people in society. And this is precisely that. So the EEOC is going after Sheetz because Sheetz is an equal opportunity employer, but they run criminal background checks on applicants to job positions. And according to the lawsuit, there's no allegation that Sheetz is intentionally behaving in a discriminatory manner on how they filter out applicants who go through this criminal background check process. However, because of the way that they do filter out candidates, it has the effect of being discriminatory, i.e., they filter out disproportionately more Black and Brown people from their hiring process than white people, that they need to be crushed under the weight of the federal government. This is the disparate impact idea that has been brought up in affirmative action cases, for example. And some of the people who are defending this lawsuit have pointed out that it's not just that Sheetz runs a criminal background check and everybody who fails the background check doesn't get hired. But basically they make a case-by-case determination as to whether or not that person should be hired. But there's an obvious explanation for this that has nothing to do with race. It's most likely the case that Sheetz decides not to hire people who have committed felonies or people who have a history of violent crime. And there are probably some misdemeanors or other cases in which they will still hire someone, even if they have technically a criminal history. So obviously, if you were filtering out people who have any type of criminal history, you would necessarily have more Black people and more Hispanic people failing that test because they disproportionately commit more crimes than white people. It's not racism. That's just a fact of life, right? And the same thing happens if you filter out via felonies or violent crime, which is that these things are more likely to be committed by Black and Hispanic people than white people. So it's not out of pocket for Sheetz to have this process where they filter out certain candidates based on the severity of crimes they commit. And there's still a disparate impact on Black and Hispanic people because, again, they are more likely to commit those types of crimes. But the Biden administration, the EEOC, is very upset about this and has decided to go after Sheetz and has sued them after apparently like a 10-year investigation. They claim they've been trying to work with Sheetz on this since 2015. This is especially infuriating because Sheetz, by all measures, is a great employer. They have numerous benefits for employees. They actually reimburse employees up to like $5,000 a year for college tuition because they view this, that a lot of these jobs at these convenience stores to obviously be for part-time young people who are aspiring to greater things and they want to take care of them while they're there. But then they offer other great employment benefits for people who work there either full-time or are older, like maternity and paternity leave. They have 401k matching. They have health, dental, vision insurance. Like, by all measures, Sheetz is the type of employer that is not the epitome of like corporate greed that the left always talks about. They are the type of employer that the left should be celebrating because they do all of these things voluntarily that are objectively great for their employees. They are a family-owned business and are regional and everybody loves them. But they've created this idea that Sheetz is operating on racist principles to filter out literal criminals from their hiring practices to crush them under the weight of the federal government. It's absolutely infuriating. It's disgusting. And even if you accept the premise, which I'm sure is what the places like the EEOC bureaucrats are operating based off of, even if you accept the premise that it's not Black and Hispanic people's fault that they commit more crimes, it's due to the legacy of slavery, which renders them more likely to be impoverished and they can't help themselves, they have to commit crime because of the systemic injustice of the country in which they live. Even if you accept that premise, why is it on Sheetz, of all places, a gas station and convenience store, to rectify those societal problems and endemic issues within the American justice system? Why does the EEOC make it incumbent upon a company to somehow change what they claim are hundreds of years of societal injustice? I mean, everything about this obviously makes zero sense. But I will let the group weigh in. I know we're short on time, but I am very pro sheets, and this makes me very angry.
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on sheets. I think they're not as common on the West, in the West Coast. But I do have an opinion on the EEOC, and I mean, look, this is it's becoming increasingly clear that the right and Republicans cannot avoid dealing with, in particular, the reforms that were made to the Civil Rights Act in the 1990s. And one of those set of reforms is what has empowered the EEOC to be what there's an excellent law review article by Gail Harriet, who I highly recommend on this issue more broadly, but it's called Title VII Disparate Impact Liability Makes Almost Everything Presumptively Illegal. So what ends up happening, if we're using this disparate impact analysis as the EEOC does when it looks at anything under Title VII, everything has a disparate racial impact, right? Amber just explained why asking your employees if they've committed a felony would have a disproportionate or disparate racial impact, right? But everything, any rule that you could possibly make, any hiring procedure you could possibly make, has a disparate impact, because it turns out we don't live in a Harrisonburgian world where like all racial groups are exactly the same on like every metric imaginable when we're talking about groups and not individuals, right? And so what ends up happening is whatever the EEOC chooses to look at is what becomes illegal. So for example, if instead of looking at this Sheets application that asks about crimes committed, it looked at, let's say, employers requiring a college degree, you would also find that that has a disproportionate racial impact. But of course, the EEOC is not going to look at college degree requirements in jobs, right? And so that thing, even though it produces the same kind of disproportionate impact racially, that remains legal under our civil rights law, while potentially asking your employees if they've committed a crime becomes, you know, potentially illegal, and your company can end up in a lawsuit, right, for asking that. So it's going to be up to the EEOC. These are essentially, our law has made us slaves to the whims of petty ideological bureaucrats in the EEOC who choose what they look at, and that thing becomes illegal, right? So this is not a tenable system. Christopher Rufo has put forward, I think, a really sensible set of reforms that Republicans and the right should be proposing in terms of the Civil Rights Act and this kind of liability. I do think this is gaining. I think even, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, it would be very difficult to find people who were willing to talk about reopening the Civil Rights Act and actually reforming it. But I think that is becoming more common, you know, a combination of Caldwell, Jeremy Carl, right? The book that Amber is talking about, Gail Harriet, like I said, has been working on this for years and years and years. I think the Overton window is shifting some, but it needs to shift faster because this is obviously absurd.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of stuff that EOC is doing to Tesla. I mean, they're suing Tesla for, you know, racial discrimination. Maybe that's DOJ when Tesla or SpaceX, rather, when SpaceX is under specific obligations to not hire foreigners, there's a lawsuit against them for not hiring foreigners because they're a national security company. And just in general, I mean, the priorities of these people are completely backwards. And I mean, it's, again, the revolt against competence, the triumph of all this ideology. It's just everything we talk about on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I've got little to add, except disparate impact is such a pernicious doctrine, and there needs to be a counter-revolution on this. And to the extent Chris Rufo and others have plans, they ought to be implemented. If it has to start at the state level and more local level, it should be done there. But this is a poisonous ideology that's used as a cudgel, obviously, to discriminate against the people that the regime wants to discriminate against and protect the people, protect, so-called, I put in air quotes, those it wants to protect. So with that, we'll go to parting shots, and we'll kick it off with Amber first.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to mention a couple of things going on at the Supreme Court that I think viewers should be aware of. There's been a few whispers going around today that the court is going to strike down Chevron deference, which is obviously a huge win against the regulatory state. That's not confirmed yet as of recording of this podcast, but that's what some people are opining on. They also just heard arguments in a case about homelessness and whether states are allowed to crack down on camping in public, which the plaintiffs argue is a criminalization of being homeless. And it seemed like the justices were quite keen on the idea that states should have the right to decide whether or not people can sleep on public property and how exactly those types of laws are enforced. And then the Supreme Court is also going to take a look at Biden's ban on so-called ghost guns, which are basically like receiver kits you can buy online to assemble your own guns. I don't know of a single incident in which a ghost gun was used to commit a mass shooting, which I think is what the Biden administration's objection to them were. But I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court will hopefully hear arguments in that and reach the same decision. So just wanted to flag those few things as some SCOTUS developments that we should be keeping an eye on.
I want to flag Hamas put out a video today of Hirsch Goldberg Polin, who is a 23-year-old Israeli American who's been held captive for nearly 200 days. It's been filmed recently. It's amazing that they don't get completely blown up for this stuff. They kidnap civilians for no reason to start off this entire war, and they're putting out hostage videos as the terrorists they are, and yet Joe Biden does nothing about them and indulges them. It's absolutely disgusting, and it's a reminder that there are still like a couple hundred totally innocent people kidnapped and just rotting in sewers underneath Rafah right now, because Hamas is an appalling organization. And there was a very good little bit, a comedic bit on that you should check out on X, which is somebody pretending to be Moses and asking these NYU protesters if Hamas should release the hostages, and their failure to give the obvious answer, of course they should, it's appalling, and he starts unleashing fake plagues on them. It's quite funny.
We would be amiss not to mention what they were, and I'm sure there's a lot more to say about it other than the brief summary, which is that after being booted from multiple venues, they finally found a venue that was willing to host a combination of, you know, thinkers on the right with elected officials and former elected officials, and then the police came in and made it impossible for a long time for them to conduct the conference. This is obviously outrageous, and it really is drawing a sharp contrast with some of the really violent ethnic protests that we've seen in places like the UK and in the European continent. That's apparently allowed, but having a orderly conference with people who are expressing national conservative beliefs, that is the line. Fortunately, I think the prime minister did weigh in and say that this was inappropriate on the part of the municipal police, but you know, there's a lot to say about the differences between free speech in America and free speech in Europe and the UK, but it's completely unacceptable. And I'm sure we'll hear more details about that, and maybe when we have a little bit less of hair on fire roster for things that happened in the US this week, I'm sure we can discuss it further. And I just one sentence I want to throw kudos to the Trump administration. I've not always been a sort of Trump booster, particularly on administrative matters. I do think they get rickrolled a lot. I thought they got rickrolled by the administrative state, by the deep state, way more than should have happened. The reason we have the Title IX changes that we discussed during the segment now before the election, it's actually not an election year ploy. I don't think Biden wants to talk about this before an election. It took this long because the Trump administration did things right. Betsy DeVos did things right. They went through the full rulemaking process. It is hard to undo that administratively. And that's what's taken the Biden administration these 3 years. Otherwise, we would have gotten these changes on year one and not before the election, and not handing at least the opportunity for the American people to discuss these changes as they make their choice for president. So some sort of rare sort of administrative kudos to the Trump administration. I think they really did a good job here. And that's the reason we're talking about it now in the context of the election. And it wasn't a day one priority for the Biden administration that they could do by mere dear colleague letter.
So briefly on the shameful NatCon episode across the pond. I would just say that we should be looking to Europe for where free speech is heading here. Obviously, we have a heritage that is antithetical and a legacy that's antithetical to the anti-speech policies that we see across much of Europe, but that is where we're headed. It may even be backdoor on the social media platforms through EU rules and regulations on quote unquote hate speech and content moderation on social media. But almost every time when you look at these illiberal policies, we're always about a decade or so behind where the EU is. We can look up to Canada and we can see it's already where the EU is in many respects. So this is something to be vigilant and really defensive about as we cling to closely to whatever remains of our First Amendment here. I would also just follow up on Will's point, worth noting that while Hamas is essentially feted by the cosmopolitan globalist elites, including our own, and then the campus radicals, what was the Biden administration doing on the eve of Passover? Well, it was imposing its quote unquote West Bank settler violence executive order sanctions on an additional organization. It was also threatening to sanction not just one, but multiple IDF units in conjunction with those sanctions. And then last but not least, there's also rumors that the International Criminal Court is considering bringing war crime charges against several Israeli leaders. And the reporting suggests that the ICC would never go forward with those policies did it not have the blessing, or were it not to have the blessing of the Biden administration. And I think to put a nice bow on things, or a sad bow on things, this is what happens when the people from the campuses end up in positions of power. Forget Joe Biden for a second, because this is simply Obama-Biden term three. Basically, what it says is the Judeo-Christian West is not allowed to defend itself, and it has to cower and submit to those who would destroy our civilization because global equity and justice demands it. And so these are the real world, utterly catastrophic consequences of the ideology manifesting itself in policy. And that's what we try to fight against pretty much every single episode of this podcast. So on that note, on behalf of Amber, Will, and Inez, thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Ben Weingarten, and we'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.